On this episode, we get to talk to the founder and publisher of Rosenfeld Media, Lou Rosenfeld.
How many bulbs does it take to screw JD up and the path to publishing?
Setting your selfish desires in the Far East, and I really cannot stand Brian's lights.
Thunder! 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 Thunder!
Welcome to the Thunder Nerds, where we always pose the trick question, who would win in a wrestling match, Lemmy or God? And the reason why it's a trick question is because Lemmy is God. I am now and forever JD Riot.
And I'm Brian Hinton.
And I'm Frederick Philip Von Weissen. You're listening to the Thunder Nerds, a conversation with the people behind the technology that love what they do.
And do good.
My job is just to hit the table. That's all I do.
Nice.
And then I am quiet until the end when I ask two meaningless questions. No, I'm kidding.
let's go ahead and get our guest in here before we start talking about Motorhead. We have the founder and publisher of Rosenfeld Media, Lou Rosenfeld. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today, Lou. How's it going, man?
You had me at Lemmy.
Yeah.
Big Motorhead fan?
Oh, Vegas.
Yeah.
I really know nothing about them, but I do know that Lemmy's God. I know that one.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
That's how you didn't trip me up at all. Mm-hmm. Metal 101, it's the class you take before. It's like, who's God? Lemmy. You ace that test. You're on.
Quick question. Right. If you knew all the cards in his hand except one, what would be the card you wouldn't know? Why'd you give it away?
It's the only Motorhead song most people know.
That's true.
Heard that. He owes you one.
Lou, I just wanted to say I really love your name. I think it kind of it adds to the prestige and it empowers the alignment of your brand because it sounds like that old English kind of feel to it. Rosenfeld, it sounds like a publishing company.
And Rosenfeld is an old English sounding name to you?
Let me tell you why. I think it kind of has that thing in my head with what's the guy from Dracula? Rosen.
Wait, no.
What?
Wrong.
Come on. No. I know it's not Lou's name, but it sounds very familiar.
What, Van Helsing?
No, dude, not Van Helsing.
Van Helsing.
Dracula's main guy.
Dracula's main guy.
Yeah, his buddy.
So there's
a German name.
Oh, no.
It's like, don't make me look this up.
No, stop.
His name is very German. It's Rosenfeld.
Are you thinking like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern?
Thinking of Dracula.
No.
Okay, I'm going to have to look this up. Dracula characters. Rensfield. That's it.
I knew he was either going to be Igor, if you like. It's Ego. Actually, it's Igor. Abby Normal.
I'm with you. I just showed this to my kids last week. So
nice.
Oh, good. Wait, share that. First time they saw Dracula or Young
Otto? Frankenstein.
Frau Blücher.
Such a good movie.
There it is.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. I'm happy. I've gotten so many movie things out. It's like my sole purpose in this podcast.
I think you and I are going to talk after this, just the two of us.
Yeah, and we can. Oh. We can go rounds.
Yeah.
So, Lou, you got into publishing from an interesting journey from library science to user experience information architecture, which you co-wrote a book, I believe, or did you actually write the whole book on the Information Architecture Bible?
I co-wrote it with Peter Morville, and the fourth edition came out a year or two ago, and we brought Jorge Arango into the mix. So, yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
That book first came out in 98.
Wow.
Yeah. We had to twist Tim O'Reilly's arm. It wasn't like your typical O'Reilly book.
Yeah, I imagine it wouldn't have been.
Well, especially for 90,
it wasn't like said
a lot of people had that kind of thought about process of information architecture. At least not a lot of people in our general industry.
Not exactly, yes. And we were still looking at O'Reilly books like Sednock, which was a great book, but It was very different for them. But, you know, what happened with that book was kind of interesting because, you know, we wrote that book, 96, 97, it came out in 98. And it was timed perfectly because there were a lot of people struggling with information problems. And those people came from different backgrounds. You had programmers, you had graphic designers, you had usability people, you had content people, on and on and on. And they were struggling to solve information problems that the web was really, you know, putting in front of us and really kind of complicating. And the book was really good because, I don't know if it was I wouldn't say it was a great book, but it was a useful book in the sense that it gave a common framework and vocabulary for people who were from different backgrounds to talk about information challenges and actually start solving some of them together.
What's funny about that is like it seems like, because, you know, when somebody writes a technology book, you think, okay, it was out June of 96. It's outdated by August of 96, you know, or something like that. So it's like but conceptually, it feels like you could probably pick that book up now, read it, and it would still parallel or, you know, some of the same problems or same issues that they're having today.
Totally. I mean, yeah, it wasn't a technology book. It was an information organization book, really. And we only have more information today, and it's crappier than it was. You know, information suffers from rot, which stands for redundant, outdated, and trivial. It just gets worse and worse over time. It could be great today, and the same information will be lousy in 6 months. So
I think also it's great for people that are just jumping into an industry that might think that the first thing they should do is learn Photoshop, or if they're a little bit more savvy, jump into Sketch. Is if they really think about the strategy that goes into design and not just design means make something pretty.
Yeah, how to think through.
How to think through the actual information architecture part of it.
Was it Einstein that said the main thing that ruins my creativity is my education or something like that?
Yeah,
it's like imagination or something that was way better for his than education for him.
Something along those lines. If it was smart, we can assume he said it. But I mean, like a lot of it was, you know, back in 96, 97, we were writing, there was so much energy and excitement about the internet, but a lot of it was very cosmetic, you know, very skin deep. And what we were really trying to get at was the fact that, well, all right, you know, the appearance is really important, but what about the skeleton? How do you hold all this stuff together?
Yeah, people were trying to make tables look nice.
Yeah. Which was important. It's not like that didn't matter.
And now.
Yeah. Yeah. Some things have really changed.
Welcome back, tables.
CSS grid. All over again.
So, Lou, how did you go from, and I want to know how you got excited about library science and then went to user experience. What was that career path like?
Well, all right. So I did library science in the late 80s. And into the 90s a bit. I did a master's degree, and then I went back for all my coursework for a PhD, which I never finished. But, I just kept hearing about the information revolution that was coming upon us. And this was something you'd hear about in college in the 80s. And I was like, well, all right, you know, that sounds pretty cool. I want to be part of that. I'll go to get a master's degree somewhere in a field that cares about information. And that's where library science came in. And, there's really was no other field that really cared about information and what it was going to mean and how we were going to work with it. And I started teaching people, I started a company actually to teach people how to use the internet and use the information on the internet in like 91, thereabouts. And what happened, this is like a side thing while I was a student. And we started teaching courses, and we found that it was getting easier and easier for people to create information. And so we started teaching people, all right, well, you can take what you're learning when you're finding stuff and put it all together and publish what you're learning on a particular topic and make it available on Gopher. You guys ever hear of Gopher?
Sounds familiar.
But yeah, so Gopher was like before the web really hit, like a couple of years, like talking like 1993, 94. Gopher sites were hierarchies. It was all hierarchical menus that you could connect to other sites' hierarchical menus. And then like the actual content was typically text files. And that was the internet. That was like the cutting edge. And then, so I was teaching people, all right, you know what? You don't just have to use the information. You can then create something for other people to use. And I was teaching this at Michigan in the program there, the library science program in 93, 94. And my students were going nuts because this was like, we're getting to be librarians, but for the world. You know, so like one student would like create a guide to personal finance resources on the internet. Another would create a guide to theater resources on the internet. And this is when the internet was young. And there was no effort really to pull things together. Yahoo didn't exist. No directories really were in place yet. There was a World Wide Web virtual library.
You were at an interesting spot too, because libraries were eventually, or like the original gateway people had, the general public to get to the internet. That's how you got, you're like, I'm going to library. I'm going to go check my email or, you know, whatever you had at the time.
Yeah, it was a library in school.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time, libraries were already facing this sort of sense of, well, no one gives a crap about us and no one wants to pay taxes to fund us and are we kind of dying? Mm-hmm. And my feeling was, well, you know what? The buildings known as libraries are under fire, but the work of librarianship should be even more relevant. So let's think not about libraries, but librarianship, and bring that to the internet. And so that's what that book was about. And Peter Morville and I wrote that around the same time we were really building my company that I founded. It's called Argus Associates, and we became an information architecture consultancy based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We were at our peak, we had about 40 people out of Ann Arbor doing IA work, which was pretty amazing. Hmm. And so I left the doctoral program. But you know, one of the things was really, you asked about the UX aspect of it. Well, it's like, all right, we were doing information architecture. We were trying to make information easier for people to find and to work with. And it's like, well, that's pretty cool. And that kind of goes really nicely with things like usability. Findability goes well with usability, goes well with delighting people, goes well with all the aspects of user experience that were starting to emerge then. And so, I found it really compelling that there was this umbrella term, user experience, that was bringing together all these people from separate tribes. And you got to understand, back in like the 80s and 90s, if you had a career, anything related to what we today call user experience, you had a career that had a defined path, and you were going to wear blinders that made sure you only took certain courses and certain programs, got a certain type of degree, went to certain kinds of conferences, read certain journals or books, and that's what your career was. If you were a technical communicator or a librarian or graphic designer, you didn't mix with anyone else. You just stayed with your tribe. And then the internet started blowing that up. And that's why we needed this thing called user experience. Yeah, so now we have all these people that just naturally synthesize and take all the methods and knowledge from all these different, what were originally were tribes, and just put it together in new ways that are really powerful. And that's really what UX is.
So was the IA Bible the start of Rosenfeld Media? Did you form that?
We started in 91. This was originally, it was started as, not Rosenfeld Media. It was called Argus Associates. But I didn't start Rosenfeld Media until 2005, because I felt very much like, all right, UX is going to grow. I want to be part of it. We need more books. All the traditional publishers that were out there were not really
friendly.
No, I mean, like, they, listen, to be honest, I approached a couple and I said, hey, listen, I want to edit a series of UX books for you. I want to be the acquisitions editor, find the authors, that sort of thing. And they're all like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. We'll dip a toe in. You can work really hard. You'll make no money doing it, but you'll have the honor of working for us. And my attitude was, screw that. I've started a business before. I'll start my own business. I'll become a publisher. How hard could it be?
Little did you know.
Little did I know. Anyway, 30 plus books later, and plus we do events now, and we're actually kind of moving past UX, but it's been a great ride over the last 11 years.
And now you got the podcast as well to kind of align both what's going on with the company. And I believe, are you more interviewing the people that your authors that you're publishing, or is it just generally everybody that's in the industry?
It's just people I want to talk with. It's people, they maybe are authors. They're often people presenting at our conferences. Gotcha. They don't have to be. They're not always, but they often end up sort of becoming one or the other at some point, it seems, once I start talking with them.
Yeah, I like that. as somebody who's going to be an author probably here really soon. I mean, I write fiction though. I mean, I'm not writing anything that's like, you know, like crazy or anything like that, but it's, well, I mean, it's crazy, but it's just not true crazy.
I'm married to one of you, so I know which the crazy you're talking about.
Oh yeah. Good, yeah. Good. Is she the crazy that you're trying to go to sleep and she's like, oh, I can't sleep. I got to go write for 3 hours.
Well, she just got back from a writing club in Manhattan. I haven't had a chance to talk to her. I had to get right on the call. But yeah, that's that kind of crazy.
So what kind of stuff does she write?
Short stories.
Short stories, nice.
Okay. Yeah.
You want to throw a name of a book out there?
No books published yet. She's just written in academic literary journals.
Gotcha.
As you know, it's really hard to get published.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter how good you are, and if you don't get published, people have been published before.
Yeah. Well, the thing too is like from what I was looking when I got shopped at, because I turned down a couple of publishers.
I just didn't read it.
And well, the reason being is because they were small house publishers and so that, and what they were offering was you could tell that they were catering more towards, I want to say, like middle-aged writers that are afraid of the internet, because their package was we're going to make a website for you. We're going to, you know, we're going to brand you. We'll publish you online digitally. And I think they would offer like editing services. Well, I have a great editor. I know how to make, they know how to make websites, you know? So I've got good friends and so like that. So I didn't see the value in it because there wasn't really much profit for what they were actually giving you. They wanted to take such a big chunk of it. So I was like, I mean, I'm not against self-publishing by any means and so like that, but I mean, I would like the ego stroke of like getting into like a random house or something like that, you know, but it's hard. It's really, really hard. Well,
can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah.
How old are you?
34.
See, if you were 10 or 15 years older, you would have grown up with a very different concept of what publishing is. You wouldn't really be thinking about doing it yourself. You wouldn't have the skills anyway. So yeah, it's tough.
It's a new world. Yeah. But it's also really, I mean, if you put it out there now with Amazon Marketplace and all that other stuff for books and, you know, iBooks and stuff like that, I mean, like, you've got, if you can get people to it, you've got a lot more opportunity. I mean, that's where books are going. So
I just had a long conversation this afternoon about getting authors to be comfortable promoting their work. And I will tell you that you may be still among the exceptions, because I have fantastic authors there, and a lot of them are just not comfortable getting the word out about their work.
Well, I mean, I think it's ingrained in me. I'm fearless in trying things. Like, I mean, that's how I learned how to sew. It's how I learned how to do makeup. It's how I learned how to do construction. It's how I learned how to write. It's like, I'm just going to do it. If it's in me, I'm just going to do it. I'm not going to let anybody say no. And I've got amazing friends and amazing resources that I can draw on and, you know, that will thankfully and gracefully help me mercifully carry my hand through the dark passageway that is that.
Well, it's all about having that creativity and that drive to do things. Yeah. Not everybody has that.
They don't always go together. I mean, you might be a fantastic writer, but you might forget to mention that you wrote a book when you're giving a keynote at an industry conference. That we have people do that all the time, and I want to strangle them.
Yeah, it's also not a rebellion. It's not a rebellion for me. You know, a lot of people write or do art or create to rebel against life or against whatever's, you know, it's their fuck you to responsibility, you know, and so that, and like past that, they don't want to make it a career or a business. I want to make everything a career and a business. Like,
why not? Why not enjoy your career and make a living off of it?
I don't get that pressure though. I don't get that pressure to please other people or like what other people want to do. It's like, if I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it on my merit and what's interesting to me. I'm going to write for me. If anybody else loves it, it's a beautiful and consequential secondary, you know?
But you know, fiction is art, and you know, in the types of books that we publish, typically it's more like design. You're creating a product for other people to hopefully use.
Yeah, it's a little different. I'm lucky in that though.
Lou, I wanted to ask you. You kind of alluded to there's going to be some changes undergoing within your company, and you said we could discuss that point. What kind of change? Sorry?
Could I interrupt? I have a quick question going back to something he said before we get into where they're
headed. Yeah, because that's going to be a topic.
Yeah, well, I kind of want to know a few of the difficulties you had initially starting it, you know, Rosenfeld Media as a publisher. What you said there were a lot of, you weren't expecting the difficulties. What, like a couple of things.
Okay. So, you know, first of all, you know, when you start something new, often you have naivete on your side. You wouldn't have done it otherwise. I mean, yeah. At a certain point, the naivete bites you on the ass because you realize you're in over your head. But it's too late that you're already in and you have to figure it out. I think for me, part of the challenge was, certainly 11, 12 years ago, getting up and running and building a commerce site and being able to handle customer service, which is for us, was really a big challenge. And also to kind of navigate the distribution side of things. I mean, I never like had a bunch of books in my garage or anything like that. We've always relied on companies to do fulfillment and distribution. It's a pain in the ass. You got to tie their system in with your system. You know, it's funny, like so much of the stuff that was really hard had nothing to do with finding really good people and getting really good books out of them. I would say, like, understanding who does what editorially on the first book was pretty difficult, but it worked out okay. I learned a lot from that. And then finally, the thing that was really hard was bootstrapping it. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect to make money publishing ever, really. I hoped to. And it took some years to actually get rid of my solo consulting operation, and which I was very happy to do, and just start making my living in publishing, which I've been doing for only about 5 or 6 years now.
Oh, really? That's it?
Yeah, well, I only had, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I only had about 10 books out. You got to have some volume. It has to build. Books are like the slow food of content. It just takes forever anyway.
Yeah.
So you got to build.
Starting at around like 2001, five. Right? It was 2005. Okay, so this is after did the bubble burst? You know.
Yeah, so my last business died in 2001. My consulting business, the IA consulting business that we had back in Ann Arbor, where we went from our peak in October of 2000 to shutting it down 6 months later, which was painful. We were like the canary in that downturn. I went solo consulting and, but I was one of the problems is, you know, especially if you're an entrepreneur, is that other people's problems are never as interesting as your own. And so I could consult for other companies, and I do so. I get really bored, tired of trying to get them to do things that I knew they weren't going to do. And said, all right, start something new. I guess I know something about books. Let's see where it goes.
So Luke, to get back to my question, then, because that makes me think of it again. What are the new things that's coming up in the company? What are the new changes?
Well, okay. So the field of UX has really matured. Like, you can go get a degree in it, right? You people are getting into it because they found themselves accidentally learning about it and even helping invent it. But now you're like, it's a good paying job. It's a growing sector. I think I'll do that and get a degree. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's changed. And people who got into it 15, 25 years ago, it's a different mindset. You like kind of being a pioneer. You like the uncertainty of this new thing will go somewhere. And so I think, you know, a lot of us who have that mindset, we've been kind of looking beyond that, but there's already things happening beyond you. If you've been in the field for 10 years, there's a good chance that you're a manager now, or a leader, or a teacher, or in some other role to help other people do good design. And you're also thinking about things that aren't just about usability, but how do you make the world a better place? What happened in fake news and, hey man, that's design right there that went awry. I mean, it's totally a fuck up. And if things like ethics and values and just sort of a certain level of thoughtfulness that a lot of people don't necessarily have in the first few years of their careers, if that was taken into account, things might have gone a bit different in November. So you know, I think a lot of us are like pushing beyond what you think of as maybe traditional standards that's being taught in academic programs right now. So we've been doing a bunch of initiatives that had kind of run out in front of our mission to do, like, to help people do good UX. And I woke up on November 8th or 9th, I guess it was, feeling like shit, like just depressed. And after months of soul searching and not really feeling excited about UX and going to work in the morning, I realized in a long conversation with my staff that what I really cared about and where this field seems to be going is humanization. How do you humanize our world, the products, the services, the organizations, the systems that we interact with and that are constantly being pushed forward by technology into questionable areas where ethics aren't really considered, where the implications aren't really being considered? I don't want my kids to grow up in a world that's dehumanizing, and I'm worried that that's what's happening right now. What is the impact of that? How are people going to live lives that are worth living in the world we're creating through technology? And design's job is to catch up to technology as best as it can and make it livable, make it human. And so that's kind of what we're refocusing our mission on. And it actually ties together a lot of the threads that we'd already been trying out and some of the directions we've been going in. And you know what? That may sound like hoo-ha. I mean, like, humanize the world. What the hell is that? I don't know, but I know it's got to happen, and I know that we're going to work on it. And now I'm excited to go to work in the morning.
So what direction are you taking Rosenfeld Media then? Are you doing more more direct interaction with potential customers, or what changes are you making?
Well, I think it's got more to do with scope, what content areas we focus on. So we're going to continue doing conferences and continue books, and we actually offer training as well. But, you know, an area might be humanizing the patient experience in healthcare. And we may make a big push 1 year in the area. And we feel like that's a leadership role. I mean, there's little bits of that going on here and there, but if we really focus ourselves on doing that, we can really help other people do a better job with books, with conferences, et cetera, to make the patient experience more humane. So there's a lot. There's also like the fact that design is becoming more and more democratized. It's in more and more people's hands today who aren't designers, never were designers, never will think of themselves as designers.
Yeah.
You know, if you're working.
A lot of those designers are a lot of the decision makers, a lot of the influencers. You have CEOs jumping in. It's interesting.
But you also have people that are like, they're in HR or they're in corp communications or they're admins, and they are focused on making systems work better for other people.
I will say,
I think your head's against the wall. Don't you think that they're designers in a way without realizing it? We got to make it better for them. We got to help them because they're the ones where the rubber meets the road these days.
Yeah, I will say that I feel like in a way that's always been a problem, except like it used to be, you know, I really want that button to be pink or, you know, something ridiculous. But it used to be we could say, we can't really do that. That's not technically possible. But now, since things are much more open, there needs to be more understanding. There's a reason the button's not pink, and there's a reason we don't do this, and there's because it's not a good experience. And that's
to jump at the loose point. It's also there's a lot of people that work in the not only the UX but CX field, like HR and things like that, that might have some interesting data to back their.
Oh, points. Definitely. Yes, definitely.
Well, so we do the Enterprise UX conference. We got the third one in June, and you've got these shitty enterprise systems that people are using. And by the way, they're often using them to help other people, like customer service systems, that type of, like their call center. And they're helping people on the phone. And every one of them is told to use this shit system when they have an iPhone in their pocket. And they know things could be better. And in fact, there's this whole term, I love it, this concept of shadow IT, where people are saying, screw you, IT. We're going to do an end run around you. We're not going to use your systems because we know there are things out there that work better because we use them in the consumer space.
Yeah.
And so they all, you cannot constrain it. You can't pretend that better design is impossible because it's in everyone's pocket today. And so when that happens, it changes the way people think, and they are increasingly empowered and empowering themselves to take responsibility for good design. How can we help them not reinvent the wheel?
Yeah. That's a very powerful statement. I completely agree with you. Andy, on that note, unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of the show. So we're going to move into kind of, we have some final questions for you. I'll be going first. And we'll go around. My first question is what I call a spotlight question. It's kind of something that you've discovered this week, something we've all discovered, or something interesting. It could be anything from tech to a new candy bar to a new beer, anything. And I'll be going first, and we'll pass around, and guest goes last. So you can quickly Google if you think or think there's something. Mine may link with Frederick's. Well, I'll find out in a second. But mine is the Moto Z Play. I have an iPhone. But I'll probably end up keeping it.
Yep.
But I always look around for what new tech there is. And I've been looking at the Moto Z Play, and I kind of like it for one thing, because it gets like 10 hours of screen time, battery life. And I've read and reviewed it a lot. I'm not talking about the Force or the other one. It's the Play. It has a smaller processor. And the modular approach, the fact that I can slap on a battery on the back, have wireless charging, all sorts of things. And, okay, Frederick.
No, that's not mine. That's fine.
Okay,
that's interesting. No, I'm going to go with Picnic, which is the plugin for Sketch. So where you could invite multiple people to your Sketch file. So it's kind of like if you're thinking about the same way of Figma, where you could have groups inside of your design file. So Picnic is the same kind of idea, where you could have your team on one sketch file and editing your same sketch file at the time. So the website is picnic.design. If anybody wants to take a look at that, and we'll add that to show notes. Jonathan.
I've got two. The first off is Marvel's Iron Fist, which has just dropped on Netflix. It's good. A lot of people said it was slow and boring, but I mean, like, I needed a slow building. This is the next one before they release Defenders. It's the last one before they release Defenders. So it was good. I really enjoyed it. I'm still enjoying it. I haven't gotten all the way through it because I worked like 70 hours this week. But anyway, you slice that. The second thing is Brian, you have got two different lights in your ceiling fan right now, and it is driving me utterly insane. Like, I looked at every time you come on the screen, it's that part in Star Trek with Picard. And he's like, there are three lights.
Three lights.
I never have that on, really. So.
Oh my God, it kills me. Please take it. those are my discoveries.
Boom, you go next. That's how much we're going
to have. So,
four different ones.
Lou, what you got?
My turn? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Does it have to be technology related?
No, it can be anything, Lou.
All right.
Coffee, so, chocolate, whatever. Feeling fan. So,
I saw a movie. Oh, first of all, by the way, there's some cool new Slack suite of tools that I can't remember the name of, so, you know, forget that. I wish I had that handy.
Sorry, Slack.
But I did have something.
Let's hear the movie.
I Am Not Your Negro is something everyone should see. It's about, and in the words of this guy, James Baldwin.
Yes.
I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah, got it.
And incredible. And one of the things that I've been working on with the number of people here in my community is trying to kind of hack the New York City Department of Education. It's a really supposedly progressive city. Public education system that has unbelievably racist, discriminatory policies in place that make sure that kids don't get a fair shake based on their race. They don't spend the same amount per kid. They don't get the same opportunities. Some kids don't get to play on sports teams. It's unbelievable. And I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but I will say, if you think this issue is over in this country, if somehow you think that still, I would really recommend James Baldwin, and hearing his words echo true today, and certainly seeing that movie, I'm Not Your Negro. Unbelievable. Yeah,
that was on my list of movies to watch, and I'm glad that you gave it a high praise, because I didn't know exactly. I looked at like a small snippet of what it was about, and I was like, yeah, I'll watch that. That's going to be good.
Definitely.
All right, yeah, we'll put a link to that in show notes. So, Lou, my question comes in, or my series of questions comes in two. One, if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
Oh, God. You know, I would like to be a tour guide in Central Asia. That would be kind of cool.
Central Asia?
Central Asia. Kyrgyzstan. I want to be on the shores of Lake Issyk-Kul with the mountains in the background. It's the Switzerland of Central Asia. I want to be there.
The Switzerland of Central Asia. That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it's supposed to be incredible.
All right.
So that's the best. That's an answer.
That's a good answer.
Handy.
All right. My last question for you, Lou, is, and a lot of people approach this with humor because it's a hard one to think of. Once you're dead, what does it look like at that very moment? You're dead. What do you see?
Oh, man. I knew you know, it's funny. You told me I would expect this question, and now that you've asked it, it just kind of really hits me hard.
What's the first thing that comes to your mind? You're dead. What do you see?
I'm just hoping, like, the last thing I see is my kids. Shit.
Well, no, the first thing you see, you're dead. What do you see?
Oh, now that I'm now, all right.
Okay. Now you tell your kids.
Oh,
like the perfect thing happened.
You know what I see? You
open your eyes. You're dead. What do you see?
Those lights.
I open my eyes. And I see Lake Issyk-Kul with the mountains in the background.
Well, there you go. See, it's all
right.
All comes back.
I tied it up in a nice neat knot for you there.
Yeah, I like that.
Mine are fun. A lot of people who are watching this are either going to be in your position, or probably are in your position, or may never ever be in the position you're in. But for the handful of people that it does help, in your industry, it's probably soul sucking. There's also like family, friends. I mean, there's a lot of things that you come up against, you know, with, like you said, like feeling depressed or, you know, or just feeling like you're not making an impact, or how do you make an impact or get other people seeing it? So that being draining, how do you recharge your battery? Do you have a Snap-on battery that you put on, like the new phone that Brian wants really bad? Or do you have, you know, you go out into nature? Do you dive into different technology? What's your point?
Three things. I run when I can. I'm trying to do more and more distance. In fact, I'm trying to qualify for the New York Marathon next year.
Nice. Good for you.
I'll be 53 when I do my first one.
Music or no music?
I'm still alive. Oh, definitely. Definitely music. And podcasts, too.
Yeah, I can't do music. I haven't tried podcasts yet.
Dan Carlin's Hardcore History will get you through at least a half marathon.
Oh, okay. Problem. There you go.
Other things that are really incompatible are coffee and meditation. But they're both great.
Coffee because it takes time to actually sit down and drink it, if you can commit to actually, like, not doing anything while you're drinking it, right?
The coffee commitment. No, it just keeps me awake. That's all. And then meditation recharges me in a different way. And I just started doing it. It's been really amazing. Highly recommended. Everyone always says that. I kind of thought they were full of crap. Now I'm trying it, so it's been good.
It's forced peace and quiet. Do you get? I don't seem you'd probably get that much of it. Did we lose Lou?
No, he's right there.
No, I'm here.
Okay. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Again, no, sorry. The screen went black for a second. I was all like, wait a minute. All right, and then
I was meditating.
Yeah, you were. Just took a second. Second to last, or just the actual last. Sorry. Your most selfish desire in this moment. If you could have anything, what is it?
Oh, God. I'd like to just go on a trip. Just get the hell out.
Leave things behind.
A business, a family, you know.
Central Asia?
The usual stuff. Central Asia. I'm telling you, I'd love to get there. I missed one about 15 years ago, and then 9/11 hit. And, son of a gun.
I don't see how that event could have possibly put any hindrance on your travel.
were you local at the time? You were in the city at the time?
No, I was actually back in Ann Arbor still. But... we had a trip planned, driving through the Karakoram Mountains in a 4x4 and into Western China, and then into Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. We had it all thought through, but stuff happens. I could have been a lot worse for us, right? I mean, yeah, think about exactly. The people here. So,
yeah, I think before the next time we have you on the podcast, because I'm assuming there is going to be a next time, I challenge you to get to that selfish desire. That seems pretty easy. It seems
it's
like
a great challenge. All right.
Yeah. All right. Well, that being said, that does wrap up the first live actual broadcast on of the Thunder Nerds. We've got Brian, who's not sick. Look at you. You champion. You moved that that camera screen so I couldn't see those lights.
Nice. Thank you, Brian. My heart looks so much better. Oh.
My heart's to you. Yes. Hey, I'll take it. Look at you. That's the way we end the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much, Lou. Thanks for being on the show. Really.
Hey guys, you're a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for including me.
Man. Great talking.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks again. Take care.
Do you have a question or topic you'd like us to discuss? Send us your text or audio questions at connect@thundernerdsho.com.
Also, hit us up if you're interested in sponsoring the show, and don't forget to pimp us on iTunes with a like or review.
I like romance novels. They have happy endings.